This is Dissecting Dragons, a speculative fiction podcast for writers and readers by writers and readers.
Hello and welcome to Dissecting Dragons, the speculative fiction podcast for writers and readers by writers and readers. I'm Madeleine Vaughan.
And I'm Jules Ironside. This week, a tale for bards, why historical fantasy works.
So, I'm actually really surprised we haven't done an episode on historical fantasy yet, considering we're both pretty big fans of it.
Yeah, it was strange, really. I suppose we've touched on it a little bit when we've talked about, because we've obviously talked about historical fantasy in a fair bit of depth.
Yeah.
Sorry, so historical fiction, not historical fantasy. Confusing myself. In a fair bit of depth. And we've talked about fantasy that draws a lot of its inspiration from history, like Game of Thrones, etc. And alternate history. We have not talked about historical fantasy, where it's a very specific genre mashup of two specific genres.
Yeah, absolutely. So it's actually quite fun. It's actually quite fun now because we've talked about most of the major genres that we can now start sort of getting into the subgenres and subcategories and the genre, you know, mashups, the crossovers. It's actually kind of fun.
Yeah, yeah, definitely. And I mean, a historical fantasy is quite a big category now. And it's a growing category. As you get more people who've had success in it, you have more people saying, oh, I'd like to write historical fiction, but with this element added to it. And I think that, again, that's part of the indie publishing process as well, because there's less people saying, oh, there's no audience for this. And demonstrably, that attitude has turned out to be incorrect anyway.
So. Yeah. And I think that it exists within the same vein as what's making urban fantasy quite popular, in that it's that whole idea of I know they're very different because obviously one is set in the present and in the kind of the world that we know, but it's the same in some senses, and we'll go into this in more depth, of there being something, you know, the world that is recognizable to you. So I think that it sort of is ticking that box on both categories, and as we see more urban fantasy, we also see more historical fantasy coming through.
Yeah, definitely. So let's nail down a definition as far as the dragons are concerned as to what historical fantasy is. So we're not talking about a fantasy that's inspired by historical events or draws heavily on sort of a Western medieval setting, and yet everything is, you know, the world itself and the characters, etc., they're all made up. We are talking about a story that is set during a real documented historical time period and has at least fringe mentions of actual historical figures, but incorporates fantasy elements of some kind.
Yeah, so very basically, it's a real time in history. It's not just inspired by a real time in history.
Yeah.
And it has fantastical elements. Now, the fantastical elements needn't be these amazing world-changing kind of things. They can be very, very low-key.
Yeah.
Sorry, every time I say low-key, it's like I've summoned him.
Yeah, they absolutely can. That's the great thing with historical fantasy, because you're starting from the position of, I guess what I'm looking at here is fantasy that's inspired by historical events. You're starting from the position of writing fantasy first and foremost, but historical fantasy, you're starting from the position of writing historical fiction and then adding fantasy to it. So you're coming from a slightly different angle. It can just be changing one element. It can be an extension of the beliefs and mores of the time period you're setting them in. And for example, Karen Maitland's eerie historical fantasy fiction is a really great example of that. I'll talk more about it later. It can be folkloric. So it can be a case of, here's this historical time period, I'm writing about these characters and these events, and then I'm adding fantasy to it from the perspective of the folklore of the time, or the folklore as we understand it. So Juliette Mirelier does that a lot with her work. It can be just one really big thing. So, for example, in Naomi Novak's His Majesty's Dragon series, which is set during Regency England during the time of the Napoleonic Wars, people are riding into battle on dragonback. Which, sorry. I'm sorry, that's just all kinds of awesome, and you know, there's some great stuff there. Or it can be, as you say, very low key. It can just be a bit in the same way that folk horror is to horror or ghost stories. It can be historical fantasy is to historical fiction, whereby there's definitely something inexplicable, something a bit magical going on. And it's usually quite a well-built magical system, but it's not as defined as it would be for, say, epic fantasy.
Yeah, absolutely. And sometimes you can really border on the fringes of it. And this is where you sort of start to intermingle with historical fantasy, the idea of there being a suggestion which is never quite confirmed, but where the fantastical elements feel a little bit too concrete to just be dismissed.
Yeah.
Which is something that, I mean, I think you've bordered on a couple of times, Jules.
That's because you can take the girl out of fantasy, but apparently that's as far as it goes. So when I try and write historical fiction, it's a real struggle for me not to put in fantastical stuff.
I do love it because you're like, ah, let's write some historical fiction. You know what this needs? A dragon.
True story, guys.
True story. It's also the fact that I took it a step further and went, and now let's make the dragon real.
What made me laugh was I sent you the first chapter of Book 3 of The King's Knight, and you went, I love how you've gone from really factual 15th century England straight into, it came out of the mist at low tide.
It was like you'd cracked. It was like you'd really tried and then suddenly went, ha-ha, they're invested now. Time to bring in the mythical beasts.
Oh, dear. I'm still amazed I got away with that with my publisher, honestly. Genuinely am.
But yeah, so that's when you basically start to kind of infringe on the historical fiction and that question of, is it believable just because it's a reasonable belief of the time? Or have you clearly left it that there does seem to be something fantastical there, even if it goes sort of relatively unexplained?
Yeah.
So there's a whole spectrum of how you can approach historical fantasy, which is probably why it's so interesting, because you have so many possibilities in how you approach it.
Yeah, absolutely. Sorry, looking at my schedule there. Right, so why does the mashup of history and fantasy work so well? So we're looking at more of the structural type stuff at the moment, because we all know I love a good structure. I can't help myself. Anyway, we've obviously covered some of this before, so we needn't go into too many details. But as a recap, the type of world building that you need for fantasy and for historical fiction is very similar in terms of detail, the sort of level of research, the creativity involved, and the immersiveness you need to create. So Madeline mentioned urban fantasy earlier, and the advantage of urban fantasy is obviously that generally it's set in the world that we know. You don't have to explain to somebody what a mobile phone is or what a television is, whereas you might well have to explain to somebody what a honey cart is or a cloaca is if you were setting something in a medieval period. Depending on, obviously, how knowledgeable people are. So that detail and immersiveness is very similar. But also you have the advantage of familiarity, because this is something that has happened. It is established.
Yeah.
And it's created a shadow in people's minds, if you like.
And I really do think a big part of the reason why a lot of fantasy relies on historical tropes is to create that sense of familiarity, is to create that sense of, right, I can understand, I can recognise what's going on, because even though people don't walk around in, you know, corsets anymore, I know what a corset is, I recognise it. So I can recognise swords, even though, again, people don't tend to run around with swords anymore. I mean, depends who you are, really. But there aren't that many out in public. No comment. She says, no tucking comment. Her sword away to the side. But, you know, it's... You don't really see it, but just because you don't see it in the day-to-day doesn't mean that we don't still recognise these things. So these things are brought into fantasy. Now, historical fantasy has the added thing is in that if you are a fan of historical fiction or in general, which you probably are likely to sort of have a dabbling interest in history if you're reading historical fantasy, you also go in understanding or knowing perhaps a little bit about the time period that this is set in. So you know kind of almost what to expect. So you get that sense of familiarity, which kind of makes it feel a bit inviting. But at the same time, just as you said, Jules, ultimately, none of us have lived in the past unless you're like Jules and you're a time traveller. or you're just incredibly old. None of
Hang
us
on,
have
which
really...
one of those applies to me?
I am leaving that hanging. So unless you're centuries old, you don't know what it was like in the Tudor period. Everything that we know, or everything that actually most of us really understand get a feel of the Tudor period is through things like movies, historical, you know, reenactments, stuff like that. But it tends to be stuff from the modern day. So ultimately, actually, we still have to consider historical works, even without the fantastical elements, as being totally alien, because no one has actually genuinely experienced them without a filter of some kind, or without a reinterpretation of some kind. Of course, fantasy then works very well into it as well. And that's also potentially why fantasy can fit so well into historical settings, because we don't know everything about what life and things were like back there. There is still this sense of mystery and also a sense of mysticism, which is attached with the past, which is why I think the genre is so attractive.
Yeah, definitely. In some ways, fantasy and historical fiction are more sister genres than fantasy and science fiction.
Yeah, I agree. Yeah.
Or, you know, at least they get filed in the same part in my head. Now, obviously, no, not everybody lives in my head, and that's probably a good thing. But, at the very least, they're very close cousins. Whereas,
can I just say that the slightly frightening implication, which is not everybody lives in my head, I'm like, how many people do, Jules?
Well, every time I write a new book, there's a dozen more added easily. So, you know, it's getting pretty crowded in there. There's also a very practical concern for things like mashing up history and fantasy, particularly if you've got the interest. And that is that historical fiction and fantasy have a crossover audience in many areas. Therefore, if you write something like that, you could potentially be tapping into both of those audiences.
Yeah. Absolutely. Yeah. So there's a lot of attractive reasons to write and to read historical fantasy, really.
Yeah, absolutely. Okay, so let's look at how it's done. And, you know, we've got a little list of how things sort of fit together. And I think we're going to go a bit more exploratory into it and talk about some of the examples along with it as well.
Yeah. Absolutely.
But one of the things that sort of I've noticed personally reading historical fantasy is the fact that the level of fantasy that you might incorporate and how it's presented depends quite often on the time period that you're meshing it with. So,
yes.
So, for example, I mean, if you... I honestly don't like to bring up Outlander, and it is more of a slipstream fiction, but the trouble is I actually enjoy Outlander, but I realize it's kind of Mills and Boone for me. Having said that, the historical fiction in Outlander is almost spot on. I mean, she's got things wrong about the general attitudes between men and women, but that's that unfortunately is the romance informing it, I think.
Yeah.
But the actual historical detail and things is really, really good. And obviously the fantasy element is a tiny amount. It's giving this modern filter to a historical time period. So it's very much a having your cake and eating it situation.
Exactly, yeah.
But I do think that if you were to write Outlander today and take somebody from 2020 and thrust them back to 18th century Scotland, they would have a completely different reaction to a woman from the 1940s, which is obviously what happens in Outlander.
Yeah.
Because obviously perspectives and things change. So that's a very, very obvious thing where you say the level of fantasy and, you know, the juxtaposition between the two change.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. And it does also really depend on the kind of story that you're ultimately trying to write, because even if we say something is historical, you know, fiction or historical fantasy, there are so many things that you can explore within that. There are so many other genres which are part of that. So if you want to have something which is ultimately a historical romance, because romance is one of the main components of Outlander, then it's going to be very different than if you're writing a historical military war story, or a historical adventure, or a historical mystery. You know, you can have all of these different elements, and that is really going to change as well how much fantasy and how and which time period you might choose.
I promise this segue is actually, or this little sidebar is actually relevant before we get into the weeds on this one. But I got sent an arc the other day called My Heart is in the Highlands. And it's basically gay Outlander.
Ooh!
Featuring a sapphic romance, which was, you know, it was quite smixy. but it was weird. It blended the two time periods. So, I mean, you can argue for actual Outlander. The 1940s is still within living memory. Therefore, it's not technically historical, even though we'd call it a period drama if someone produced something in the 1940s. This was the heroine was from 1888 London, and she built a time machine and went back to 18th century Scotland, where she met a tall, tall redhead warrior lass.
this is sounding better and better every word you say.
It was actually pretty good. I mean, don't ask for details on the time machine, because it was kind of like, apparently that's none of our business as readers, so we're not getting any detail on that. It was just a case of, I'm bored with Victorian London, nothing's as progressive as I want it to be, so I'm going back 200 years.
I do love the idea, which is that the idea of London isn't, Victorian London isn't progressive enough for me, I'll go into the past. because I know in some ways the past was more progressive for certain rights and things like that, but in other ways, anyway, sorry, continue.
I mean, I honestly think that the, I can't remember the names now, this is awful, I only like read it a couple of weeks ago, I can't remember the names of the characters now, but the Scottish warrior lass was kind of like really alpha male. And I think this was kind of like, again, this was the romance informing it. This was someone saying, I want a sapphic romance. I want lesbian sex on page. And I want one of them to be like clearly quite dom. And that's where it went. So in some ways it was pure wish fulfillment. But again, the historical stuff was actually pretty spot on. So you can get away with a hell of a lot if you've got your groundwork laid out. That's all I'm saying. It's like, never mind the fact that there was no science and didn't explain the time machine and the fact that she decided that going back 200 years was more progressive.
I'd also really like to know, like, when she went back in time, could she also, like, jump to a different place? Did she go back in time to London and then have to get to Scotland? Or she somehow managed to get from London to Scotland with the time machine?
I think that falls under, again, we're sketching over the whole time and space being different things.
Right,
so
okay.
She's just like, oh, I'm getting my time machine and I'm back. I mean, admittedly, when H.G. Wells wrote The Time Machine, it was literally a box with a lever in it. So I don't suppose I can be too picky, but...
Box with a lever sounds about right.
It's like, how does it work? Well, you pull the lever. Yeah, but how does the lever work? Well, you pull the lever.
How do you control which way you're going? Just pull the lever.
Like, hang on a minute, shouldn't there at least be a clock or a dial or something?
Shut up! Don't question me!
Anyway, sorry, I've gone a bit off-piste, but I wanted to mention it because I think that mashed up... Yes, it was historical fantasy, but it was also a little bit of slipstream, some science fiction, some steampunk, and obviously the growing sort of LGBTQ type umbrella genre, which is coming about as well. So that was really interesting.
That definitely sounds amazing, that must be said.
And smut as well. I must warn you of the smut, just in case people are like, oh, I don't like my romance with too much smut. There's much smut.
So it's adult. It's adult schmexy.
Yes. Everything is described.
Thanks for the warning. Okay.
Right, so going back to what we were talking about, we were looking at different eras and how certain eras lend themselves very well to particular types of fantasy. See, I can get back on the tricycle.
Good job.
Okay, so for example, the Victorian era lends itself very well to gothic, supernatural, or steampunk elements.
It really, really does. And this is also the other thing that one really has to consider about why you decide to write historical fantasy. Because it's not the same as just saying, I want to write fantasy, and it's just going to have a vaguely historical setting. When you specifically choose to set something in history, there is going to be a reason for it. There's going to be something intrinsic within that time, within that society, which is going to be part of your story. It doesn't really make sense if you just go, ba-ba-da-ba-da, and I will happen to just set it during this period of time. Because then it's not going to fit. The story has to really work. Now, the Victorian period, and Jules and I have talked about the Victorian period a lot, because the Victorians can be blamed for pretty much everything. But the Victorian period obviously really lends itself to the Gothic, mostly because that was when the Gothic was really popularised, and therefore there was a lot of Gothic material coming out of that period. But also because it was a time of incredible change, and also a time of great emphasis on the supernatural, where people suddenly started playing around with mysticism, really kind of trying to get back to those mystical roots, whilst also jumping forward in terms of technology. So of course you have this whole, okay, but what if there were demons? Okay, but what if there were ghosts, haunted houses? But also, what if actually we did build a time machine? What if everything was through steam power possible? So steampunk and the Gothic really, really are at home in the Victorian period because they are elements which are born of the Victorian period.
Yeah. So a good example for me, which weaves a lot of these sort of things together, is, I want to say, Colleen Hewick. I could be wrong about the surname, but her Stoker Holmes series, which basically a steampunk series whereby Aramina Holmes, who is Sherlock Holmes's niece, and Bram Stoker's younger sister, who actually got the vampire slaying gene when he didn't.
Right.
Which Bram Stoker is, by the way, totally bitter about and doesn't really talk to his sister because of this. She became the vampire hunter in that generation. So they've taken, you know, genuinely recognisable historical characters or characters of the history, whatever. I think even Sir Conan Doyle turns up at some point to do some documenting. And obviously Queen Victoria's in there as well, very briefly. They end up teaming up, so you've got the greatest young investigative mind and you've got the youngest vampire slayer, and they team up to destroy vampires in London and to solve a series of mysteries. And there's all sorts of steampunk-esque type things. So you've got, I can't remember her name, it's really awful, but the Stoker girl kind of dresses very much in sort of the Gothic fashion. Whereas Mina Holmes is kind of like, Yeah, I think what I prefer to wear is is more of, it's basically steampunk, but they don't call it steampunk. So she has hats decorated with cogs and things. it's young adult. It's a very fun series, but it does blend fantasy and historical fiction really, really well, through the medium of obviously the paranormal and obviously steampunk.
Fantastic. Which makes me think about Penny Dreadful.
Yep.
as a series. Apparently there's been a new one which is set somewhere else. I don't know. I'm just going to ignore it. The original Penny Dreadful, which obviously was taking all of these characters from Victorian Gothic. So Frankenstein, sort of Dracula, you know, all of these characters start appearing. And it quite successfully kind of mixed things up a little bit, because on the one side you do have the quite steampunkish element of Frankenstein bringing people back to life.
Yeah.
And then on the other hand, you've got literal vampires and witches. But it's all set within a society which doesn't know that magic exists.
Yeah, and obviously Dorian Gray is swanning around and sleeping with everything.
Of course, Dorian Gray is there as well. Can I just say, with the books that you were just talking about, I've noticed something that really made me laugh, which is that everyone else is based on someone who's true, but for some reason Sherlock Holmes and Conan Doyle both...
Yeah, they both came in the same place. Yeah, I remember reading that and I was kind of like, why is he having lunch with... never mind, maybe we're just supposed to think he's documenting this. I don't know.
Yeah, maybe Conan Doyle was the original Watson. Maybe that's what's going on. Let's just pretend that's what's happening.
I was kind of like,
make sense.
The books are fun. You kind of had me at hello at that point, so it's like, you know, I'm willing to overlook the fact that I think the trouble is there is this thing, and this is no offence is intended, but particularly amongst American authors, where Sherlock Holmes himself gets treated as though he was almost an actual person, you know, a real life person.
Yeah.
Rather than a fictional character. And there are a few books like that, and it is very noticeable that it's particularly the American audience that seems to have gone in that direction.
Yeah, like, he wasn't a real person.
Like, it was codename for Conan Doyle.
But that's the thing, is like, even if it was, Conan Doyle wasn't Sherlock Holmes. Conan Doyle was very clearly Watson. Which is also quite funny, because Watson's meant to be the attractive one. It's clearly a self-insert. Anyway.
Okay, moving on. So, Regency, the Regency period, obviously Regency, we're talking about that brief period of time where King George III was... presumably through Porphyria, a little bit on the nutty side, mm-hmm. not capable of ruling, and his son, George IV, was a bit of a reprobate in tights.
I love it, because when in doubt, just say George.
George. Yeah, you know the nursery rhyme, Georgie, Porgy, Pudding and Pie, kiss the girls, made them cry? That's George IV.
Yeah.
Not considered... You only have to look at the Punch cartoons from the era to understand how he was thought of at the time.
Yeah.
It's Jane Austen's period. It's the time that she largely was writing in. Mm. And it's fascinating. It's only a really brief window of time, and yet so many people managed to wedge so much happening. It's got to be like the busiest period in British history, considering how much happens there.
Well, yeah, because again... just like with the Victorian period, it was a time of great transition as well, I think.
Yeah, things were definitely changing. And, you know, obviously we've talked about this with the Jane Austen episode, but it was a time that there wasn't any freedom of speech. I think people forget that this was a thing, that freedom... We still don't have a charter of freedom of speech over here, by the way. People just assume you've got it, but we don't actually have a constitution that supports that. So, you know, it wouldn't go down well if the government ever turned around and said, no, you may not speak. We have to be a bit more like China, where everybody has to agree with with the government. And yeah. that would not go down well because we're generally a nation of people who refuse to agree with those in authority and yeah. have been for many centuries. But we don't actually have that written down. And in Jane Austen's era, you could be locked up indefinitely yeah. at His Majesty's pleasure if you criticise the Crown, the government or the Church. So when we talk about Jane Austen writing stuff in code, she was being very edgy and very dangerous. That was one yeah. of the reasons she concealed her identity. So it's really interesting when you then get people like Susanna Clarke, with Jonathan Strange and Mr. Norrell talking about the Napoleonic Wars. And the fact
yes.
they're not going terribly well for Britain. Obviously in Jonathan Strange and Mr. Norrell, magic is coming back into England.
Yes. And it's all about changes things.
It certainly changes things. All these very British magicians. Obviously I've just mentioned Naomi Novak's Temeraire as well, so obviously the Napoleonic Wars, but on Dragonback. It's the only way to conduct them, clearly. Yeah. But I think Jonathan Strange and Mr. Norrell did it in a way that, you know, other people have sort of not necessarily imitated it, but approached, but not ever really captured it, because she has done it in such a detailed way. She has woven the history and the fantasy together in a way that makes them almost inextricably linked. It'd be very difficult to pair them out. Yeah. As in, there are folk tales that she's made up and woven into that world. There are moors and manners. Being a magician, for example, was an occupation for a gentleman.
Yeah.
Someone of means. And it's just really fascinating. It's an amazing world, and it's so immersive.
Mm. It is. It's incredibly interesting as well, because it's... As you say, one of the big things, one of the key things, was the Napoleonic Wars at the time. But it's also a time of incredible classism.
Yeah.
As well. And again, it's also a time where in Britain we have a lot of popular fiction coming through. And really, this is something you can notice, is like whenever we have very popular fiction coming through from certain periods, we tend to write about those periods. So everyone loves Shakespeare in England. Everyone loves the Tudor England. Also because, we'll get to that in a second, but, you know, shenanigans.
Yeah.
Everyone loves the Tudor England. Everyone likes Regency because Jane Austen has really popularised that period as well. Everyone loves the Victorian period. So there's a lot of things that are coming out of it, which I think is part of the attraction. But again, the Regency period itself was very interesting because there were things that were in motion. There were things that actually had a lasting effect within history. I mean, everything's had a lasting effect, you know what I mean. But these are things which are prominent within our, you know, within our history.
Yeah, yeah, definitely. And I think there is a certain romantic cast to it, because on the one hand, you've got the reform of the prisons at the time. I don't know if you know much about this, but torture became illegal sort of in the late 1500s.
Yeah.
It was still applied in some cases.
Yeah.
Oh, you know, specific forms of torture, sort of thumb screws, rack, boot, that sort of thing. Yeah. But they kept a lot of those things. So when you had, you know, some of the big prisons in London, even the debtors' prison still kept a lot of those instruments and things. So they weren't, like, great places to go and stay. And it was interesting how, at the time, you had human rights butting right up against this wall of aristocracy and privilege that did not want to budge.
Yeah.
And yet was aware that it needed to change, because it only had to look across the channel to France, where they were executing the aristocrats.
Yeah.
For pretty much the same thing, to realise that actually we need to give way a little bit. There needs to be a place for people to go.
Yeah.
In all honesty, we probably would have had revolutions and things over here, similar to the French, if we hadn't have had the Peasants' Revolt and several revolts since then, which never ever really let the upper classes completely rest on their laurels.
No. And it is really a very interesting thing in terms of France's history, and I'm not going to go into this too much, but about why the Aristo sort of became the way that they did. Because there were two levels of Aristo. The one level were the Aristo were kind of like the country Aristo, who were on sort of the lower level they were in charge of states and things like that. Not saying they weren't corrupt or anything, many of them were, but they were sort of more in tune with what was happening around them.
Yeah.
And then you had the higher level aristos, who were all in Versailles, who sort of, the king kept everybody all in one place, all together, gave them menial jobs, and it was very much a, if you wanted to be anyone, you had to be there, you know, and they were all there. And the reason for that originally was a very good reason, which is one of the previous kings, one of the Louis, I'm sure it was a Louis, that we had many of them.
You had at least 14 Louis, so you
had,
know.
At least 14, so it was probably a Louis at some point, who had trouble kind of really securing his rule. What he did was that he set up this system so that he could keep an eye on all of the aristos so that no one could plot against him. So it was quite a sort of clever ploy to basically make sure that he could control what was happening and make sure that no one could sort of amass anything against him. But it had the unfortunate repercussion of this system then staying in place to the extent that the aristos became so totally and utterly disconnected from the rest of the country that they just didn't see any of it coming at all, and being ridiculously decadent. And that never really happened in England. We didn't have the same kind of thing. Sort of the whole court thing happened on one side, but because there was unrest very frequently in England over long periods of time, it's a little bit like everyone kind of got used to being shaken up a little bit, so they were quicker to react.
Yeah, the other thing is purely practical, is the fact that the British nobility did not have the huge land blocks that the nobles in France had. So
yeah.
While someone at, you know, one of the king at French court could say, yeah, I think I'm going to keep you under my eye, you may not leave court without my permission, because yeah. I happen to know you own quarter of a France, and,
yeah.
and your people are loyal to you before they're loyal to me.
Yeah.
You wouldn't get that in quite the same way. So yes, your nobles were generally untouchable in their own lands here in England, but they didn't, their lands were quite often sort of spread out all over the UK.
Yeah. Yeah. Which definitely makes a difference.
Definitely. Anyway, we've gone down a history sidetrack. So just so that it's not a completely fruitless sidetrack, there is actually a book I read. Oh, God, what's it? I want to say I was going to give it the name of the Italian fairy tale, and that's not the right one. I think it might be. Basically, it's a Rapunzel retelling.
Hmm.
And obviously the Italian tale is Petrasnella. Maybe it's called. This is really going to. Do my head in. But anyway, it is set in the same time period, and obviously it takes the story of Rapunzel and sets it with the historical figure of the person who first wrote it down for the French court, as she was banished off to a convent, and then it sort of travels back through three other time periods so that you get sort of historical Italy during the Renaissance and things as well. So there is fantasy to be had in every historical time period.
Yes, there really is.
I want to say bitter herbs, but I'm not sure that's what it's called. Okay, so moving a little bit forward in time, the 1930s and 40s seem to work very well with a blend of science and magic.
Yes.
So a really good example for me would be Libor Bray's Diviners series, which is set in Prohibition America, New York.
Mm.
And as the, you know, the quartet expands out, it travels, you know, across the country. And this is a group of, well, you say teenagers, but you have to bear in mind in the 1930s, at 17 in the 1930s, you would have been considered old enough to leave home and go and get married and have children. So yes, they are young adults by our standards, but by the standards of the time, they would have been considered young, but not actually that young.
Yeah.
So they're sort of 17 to 20 year olds with, you know, supernatural abilities. And they end up fighting this very supernatural creature, which is coming from another world. And you find out that someone who's experimenting with some quite illegal and very bad types of science is the thing that's keeping the rift between worlds open so that this creature can come through. It all gets very, very dire, and all muddled into this is also things like the state of affairs between sort of, you know, immigration. So the Chinese immigrants coming into New York, the Irish immigrants coming into New York, the fact that, you know, you have Polish Jews coming through. So it's an incredible, you know, what the state of affairs were if you happened to be gay, for example, as well. If you happened to be black, how you were treated, how you were shoved into a different part of New York and expected to keep there. The fact that, I mean, there's one couple in particular, and she is actually half Native American, but she passes for white. And because she didn't know that she was half Native American, you know, as far as everyone's concerned, she's white. But she can't walk hand in hand down the street with her boyfriend because he's black. So Libba Braid does a really, really great job of balancing all these things and weaving it all together. And the fantasy actually enhances the whole experience of this historical world and all its difficulties.
Yeah. And this is actually, I think, an example of actually historical fiction, historical fantasy written during that period works particularly well in America. Because there is this whole concept, this whole setting of all these groups of people coming together and bringing with them different things. You know, it's a little bit how, like, in sort of English history during colonialism, when all of these, you know, different things were being brought back, there was this idea of the mystical Orient, you know, she says in inverted commas, and those different kinds of magics and stuff like that, because it was foreign and it was different. And then you sort of get that a little bit with later periods in America, where it's suddenly all these people are coming in and they're strange and different and they're all bringing different things with them. And of course, with America, there was always the very popular, the Native American curse, Native American burial ground and all that jazz, which came into it of, it is different. A lot of these stories which involve fantasy like that play with the concept of new versus old. You certainly see that in a lot of Victorian things, but it's not just new versus old, it's civilized versus savage. So it's the idea of, look at these uncivilized people, they're set in the past, they know these ancient magics. You know, you get that particularly in things like, voodoo, and things like that.
Yeah.
You have the whole voodoo magic, and it was a voodoo witch came and did this for me. It's like, no, that's not how it works, but never mind. and you've got that playing in the whole, that's the old world, that's the uncivilized world, compared to us, you know, this new, bright, civilized world. And so you get this appearing a lot in periods or places where there's suddenly a clash of cultures and a clash of people, and racism and bigotry and prejudice all kind of in one melting pot. So I can really understand why those would sort of be very interesting points to write about.
Yeah, definitely. Going way, way back, saying prehistory. Prehistory. So we're talking about, I suppose, the Neolithic period. So you've got early humans living in caves and huts made of mammoth ivory and hide. And it fascinates me. I've read an awful lot about the time period and the anthropology of the time and how society might have set up, and the fact that we may have started as matriarchal and then a cataclysm has caused us to become more patriarchal in nature. All of that really fascinates me. So I'm basically living for the day when some intrepid writer out there writes me a historical fantasy set during this period with mammoths and cave lions and things, and a really well-developed, you know, magic system, and, you know, throw in some elder gods if you want. Gods that we forget the names of later on, and demonic forces and shamanism. That's great. It has kind of been done a little bit. If you take Jean M. Auld's series, The Earth Children, aside from being very smutty reads,
It's all the smutty reads with you, isn't it?
Not intentionally. Honestly, it gets to the point where you're kind of like, well, I've read it once. I'm really back to reading this again because I want to watch them butcher that deer again because that's far more interesting. But it does flirt with the supernatural a little bit in the sense of, in a very, as we understand, a shamanic sense. So these are early humans, and humans are reason makers, and they're trying to explain why they're there and what forces move their lives. So they obviously have their medicine men and their holy leaders and things who commune with the spirits and intercede on behalf of your average sort of hunter or what have you. And it's really interesting. In the way that many sort of tribal societies today still do, they use certain plants and things to enhance hallucinogenic experiences. Yeah. And there's some interesting bits, like the main character at one point in, I think it's the third book, takes the root of something which has got very, very strong over time, and she doesn't have the right mind guiding her. And she flashes forward in time and actually kind of gets a glimpse of the 20th century. We're not told explicitly because obviously it's from her point of view and she doesn't understand what she's seeing. But we, the readers of the 21st century, understand very much what she's seeing. So they're not quite historical fantasy, but I haven't found the historical fantasy set in that time period I want yet. So, you know, if anyone's listening and this sounds like your bag, write it for me, okay? I haven't got time.
Added to the list of things that Jules has to do. I do kind of want to make a little jump to something which hasn't been added to the list, and actually just talk about the medieval and sort of Renaissance period, which are also great because, again, these are moments of change. And things like that. And, you know, there's a lot of things of significance happening there. Now, obviously, the Tudor period is a hot spot. The War of the Roses period, big hot spot for some elaborate shenanigans in historical fantasy. Philippa Gregory is all over that. She really is. And I think Philippa Gregory is probably the first example I have of historical fantasy that I ever read the first time.
Yeah.
Now, her historical fantasy tends to be quite, well, at first it was quite light. And the fantastical elements were relatively small, but she's done her research. It's opinionated, and obviously there's a great level, which is a great deal of emphasis, which is put onto the romantic side of things. But she really is making use of the periods. And it's not just that it's set during those times. Very frequently it's set around or even about real historical figures and weaving the fantasy into it. I haven't read all of her things, but I do remember reading The Queen's Fool, which I really, really enjoyed, which is about a young Jewish girl who has the power of foresight. She gets visions of the future. And she somehow ends up working for Mary Tudor, Queen Mary the First, as her fool, who was actually a documented person. And I just thought it was brilliant. I thought it was really, really good because obviously there were all of these things that were happening politically, religiously, you know, historically. It was a brilliant time, and using the magical element added some freshness but also new perspective to the way that things occurred without anything actually changing in terms of the history. So I quite like the way that she did that. On the other side of things, I felt like I should probably mention Leonardo da Vinci. Because Leonardo da Vinci is the catch-all which is we need sort of some sort of amazing technical device which was invented during this period. You know who we can say it was built by? Leonardo da Vinci. Is it magical or a little bit strange? Leonardo da Vinci. He's great. And again, he is therefore, and his works and stuff like that have been a big feature in a lot of historical fiction, but also historical fantasy kind of things. And a good example of that is actually a series I've mentioned before called Da Vinci's Demons, which is just, they've decided to actually make it about Leonardo da Vinci. So it gets very fantastical. Really, really fantastical. They meet Dracula, which is great fun. But it is actually, it's Vlad the Impaler, who is also very clearly Dracula. But is he a vampire? Who knows? He's definitely Vlad the Impaler, and he's terrifying. There's this very weird magical thing going on the whole way through it. And time sort of keeps sort of jumping a little bit, and it's very peculiar, but I really did enjoy the series, and it was this nice mix between technology and magic.
Yeah, definitely. Okay, final example, and I'll keep this brief because we're running out of time. What I've seen done very well with historical fantasy is when you take something like ancient Greece and you blend myth, fact, and a little bit of modern perception together as well. And this is done particularly well with Madeline Miller's books, The Song of Achilles and Circe. And I was thinking, oh my god, actually, is Song of Achilles all that supernatural? Because really, it's just like the Iliad, but obviously from Patroclus's point of view, etc., etc. And I was like, don't be stupid, Ironside. At one point, a centaur turns up and starts training them both. So, yeah, obviously it's historical fantasy. How many centaurs have you seen clopping around? But my point is, obviously, it's done so well and so relatably that the fantasy elements just seem to be part of the history. And you could argue the same with Circe, even though she is technically the daughter of a titan. So, you know, the daughter of a god and lives for a very long time, etc.
Yeah, fantastic. You know, it was weird because I was the other... quite recently, my father has just read the book Thief. I got him to read it and he really enjoyed it. And I was actually thinking of it as historical fiction. And then I was like, it's historical fantasy, Madeline. And I was like... is it? You know, everything is there. And I'm like, it's narrated by death, Madeline.
So the lines can definitely blur. We were going to talk about some of our favourite historical fantasy, but I think before we do that, shall we just talk about the drawbacks and what can go wrong with this genre mashup?
Yeah. So I mentioned before that there has to be a reason for why you are setting it in certain points in history. It's not enough to just say, I want it at a different time. Different points of history will have something going for them, which will make the story appropriate for them. And just because it's fantasy, if you are writing historical fiction, doesn't mean that you can be inaccurate with your history. You can take, you know, you can play around with it a little bit if you want, but ultimately, if you don't really do your due diligence, people are going to get annoyed.
I think, yeah, definitely. And obviously there is the doubling effect of that because people who read historical fiction and the people who read epic fantasy are some of the pickiest readers ever. And they will pull you up on it. They will absolutely pull you up if they think you've cocked up. So expect that.
Yes.
The problem for me is that if you write in a historical time period and you think it's fine because it's fantasy and I can do whatever I want, it's that you're quite often you're perpetuating the same misunderstood nonsense that has been perpetuated since, you know, the Victorians decided history was a field of study and, oh, let's remove all the women, gays and black people. So it becomes a real issue. And then you get things... if you've managed to get through the year without seeing an internet argument about something like oh, I don't know, let's take The Witcher. Obviously, it's, you know, Polish folklore. But people were complaining that there were so many black characters in the background in it. And it's a case of, if you genuinely believe that everyone in Poland at that period in time, which admittedly it was fantasy, was white, then then you don't know. You're ignorant. Your understanding of history during that period of time, or roughly when it was supposed to be, is false. So if you then go into writing historical fantasy and what you're writing is, oh, but everybody would have been white, then you're wrong. Okay, it's not just a case of, oh, I want to write this because I'm writing from a white perspective or what have you. It's like, you are factually wrong. And this is a real issue. If you're writing something set during the 14th century and you think all women did was stay home and keep house, you're completely and utterly fucking wrong. I cannot emphasize enough how much of a problem this is. And to keep, you know, adding more to the fire that keeps burning, saying, well, only men did things right up until sort of 1880. It's really, really frustrating. The idea that gay people just sort of, a few of them turned up in the late 1800s, you know, they were the very progressive gays who turned up for Oscar Wilde's readings or what have you. It's just like, yeah, we're ahead of the curve here. The rest of us won't be invented until 1980. It's just...
We've only just been created.
With the T-800s of the gay community. It's just... there you go. It's just wrong. That there's no other word for it. It's just factually wrong. You have to do your research. If you do your research, you'll find out things like there's been gay marriage for centuries. You'll find out that many, many cultures have had more than two genders for thousands of years. You'll find out things that, you know, women as blacksmiths was quite a common occupation during the medieval period. And everything that men did, women did as well. The only thing that was precluded from both sexes doing it was childbirth, largely because there were biological implications.
Yes. But, you know, even then, the point is that, it was very much a diverse world. We've had a diverse world which is full of different people. And I think the problem is that a lot of fantasy that we read now is based off of material which has come from very specific periods. And again, the Victorians, as I said, we can blame pretty much everything on them. The Victorians really perpetuated this, rewriting history and how we understand it. And then, of course, fantasy itself as a genre has taken major influence from certain things, particularly Tolkien and stuff like that. So they're products of their time. So for us to continue drawing our information from things which were products of a very specific time and somehow assuming that therefore covers our entire history is naive, and actually really limits us in terms of being creators.
Yeah. It's not good enough to read someone else's work, say, I want to write something like that, and assume that they had their facts right. You must go back and do your own research. If you're literally starting with a position of history and just adding fantasy to it, you must absolutely do your research. And that means seeking at least three opinions on every major subject. Yeah. If that sounds like a lot of work, it's because it's a lot of work and you should absolutely do it.
On the flip side of this, because you do have the fantastical element as well, feel free to use that in order to diversify a story as well. If you feel like, actually, I want to have an excuse for why we might have X, Y, and Z there, which doesn't seem very historically credible, well, great, you can do it. And people complaining about The Witcher saying, well, it's, you know, it's set in Poland. No, it's not. It's set in wherever that is, which is inspired, you know, by Polish mythology. It's not a real place. In the same way that if you look at Prithian from A Court of Thorns and Roses, right? You look at the map, it's very clearly England and Ireland, right? Right? Okay. Yep. but that would mean that the Night Court are Scottish,
which they're not, though I like to imagine them as Scottish, but also you've got the different courts in different places who have very, very kind of different sort of, like, landscapes that you would find. Like, you're up in the North Country and you've just got this, like, desert, this perpetual summer. I'm like, gotta break it to you, that's not how that works. So if we're agreeing, yes, magic has therefore made, you know, certain climates and things like that, and that's how the courts work, then it's not unreasonable to say, and guess what? They weren't all white. So, if you are, obviously that's not historical fantasy. I'm just using that as an example because obviously it's actually based off the geography, whilst also being entirely inaccurate. The point is that if you are writing historical fantasy, you can actually use that to play around a little bit. You don't need to put yourself in a box in terms of, you know, saying it can only be this way. And people who complain and say, well, that's not historically accurate, you can point out the fact that, no, it's not historically accurate. Or actually, it might be historically accurate, but this is also fantasy. So there is the flip side of that as well. Basically, use your power, you know, with care.
Yeah, but definitely start from the position of actually knowing what we factually know is
definitely
true first.
So yeah, make sure that you understand the history. And then if you want to make changes, do it from there. Because I think you'll find that if you understand the history, it's very difficult to justify saying, well, I can see historically there were black people in the country at the time, but because of my fantasy world, I'm going to remove them all. It's very difficult to justify yeah. that, to say, well, actually, I see that historically there wouldn't have likely been many Chinese people here at the time, but because of my fantasy, I'm going to add a few. It's a very different situation.
Definitely. So for the last few minutes, we're just going to look at some of our favourite historical fantasy. I want to mention one called Grave Mercy, which is by Robin Lefevers. It's part of a series, and it's set in 14th century Burgundy. If you don't know very much about the time period, basically Burgundy was not part of France at the time. Burgundy was at war with France. France and Burgundy hated each other. Big, big time hated each other. This does take several documented historical figures who are in the fringes, but it's from the perspective of various different women, so it's sort of a young adult series and it has strong fantasy elements. Basically, instead of there being just one sort of Christian god, you have something like a small pantheon of saints who sort of intercede in between, and one of these saints is actually, you know, the god of death. And these women who are kind of like misfits, because one in the first book has a birthmark right across her body, and she is considered flawed because of that, and her father was going to force her into marriage with a man who, you know, turned out to be a bit of a brute. But she managed to escape, and she got to this convent, which is just off the coast of France, full of women who are basically assassins.
Oh, great!
And they take in these young misfit women and train them up, and then they dabble in political affairs by sending them out there. Now, obviously, if it's a convent full of assassins, it sounds really cool, but if you kill people for money, you're probably not on the side of the angels.
No, probably not, really.
However, these nuns or what have you, they're not nuns in the traditional sense of the word, they are dedicated to the god of death. And occasionally the god of death shows up and has a chat with one of them, or, you know, emphasises some particular thing. It's a really, really great series. Obviously strong fantasy elements, but the history is pretty spot on. Although I'm pretty sure that the author's been a little bit mean with one particular French lord there. I'm not sure he was quite as bad as she's painted him, but you never know.
Fantastic. And yeah, Bourgogne was not always part of France. Some good, sorry, there's a lot of great folklore and stuff which has come out of some of that conflict, which I quite like. So I might actually have to read that just for that alone, because I'm a nerd. So one I want to mention is actually one of Philippa Gregory's young adult books.
Yeah.
Called Changeling. And it's set around the 1400s, mid-1400s. For the life of me, I can't even remember where it's set. It's certainly not set in England. In fact, I'm almost certain that it's set in Italy. And they actually sort of end up kind of travelling a little bit across Europe. Because I suggest that it's set in Italy because the main character is called Luca Vero.
Yeah.
Which, to my untrained ear, sounds Italian, but I might be entirely wrong. But yeah, it's a fantastic piece. And arguably, because I've only read the first one, you could argue that it's not actually historical fantasy, because the fantastical elements are never really confirmed. But there's enough there that makes you question. Like, they face like things like werewolves, and all sorts. You know, there's dark magic, there's madness and things like that. And what they're trying to do is they're trying to prove that it's all kind of, that there's logical explanations for everything. But as is Philippa Gregory's way, there's this undertone of inexplicability. And I'm pretty sure it was her first YA book. And it's very good, actually. I really, really enjoyed it. So I do highly recommend it as a novel. And I think I'm actually going to have to read the rest of them, because I read the first one when it first came out, and then I was, you know, sat there like, when's the next one? And I'm pretty sure that now there has been a next one, and I just haven't touched it. So I might have to go back to that.
Yeah, I mentioned Karen Maitland earlier. Karen Maitland writes what can only be termed as historical crime fantasy. Usually there's a mystery to be solved. Crime's probably the strong word. Historical mystery. But there's always a very strong fantasy element, and there's often a strong folkloric horror element as well. So The Company of Liars is kind of like a very, very dark Canterbury tale. In some respect, a group of travellers are thrown together during a really horrendous winter during the early 14th century, and they end up agreeing to travel together out of convenience and for safety, because sort of England during the 14th century, as Edward III starts to fade into his dotage, it was a rough place to be. There were brigands and there were bands of robbers and things. People were hungry. Villainage was still rife. So, you know, it was very difficult to move around safely. Mm. And it turns out that every single one in this group has a secret. And they take in this very strange girl with white hair. She's described as almost being sort of albino, but she could have just been sort of Icelandic. Mm. And she reads runestones and she tells people their futures. And then something very sinister starts to happen. And she seems to be at the centre of it all. You know, it sort of turns into an Agatha Christie type and then there were none type scenario as people start to die. And by the time they really start to suspect this girl, who she, you know, admits at the very beginning that she hates liars, it gets very, very creepy. And it brings in a little bit of sort of Catholic mythology as well, with the Hounds of God. And so that one is very good. Mm. There's the Gallows Curse as well, which is incredibly disturbing. Again, set in the same time period. She's got a couple that are set during the Black Death. Again, as if the Black Death itself was not horrible enough, you have ghosts and demons and people making Faustian bargains.
Hooray!
And the other one is the Falcons of Fire and Ice, and that is set during in France during the Spanish Inquisition, and a young Jewish girl, in order to save her family, is sent to trap a pair of snow white gyre falcons for the French king.
Right.
But they're not easily taken. They're considered quite mystical birds. You have to go all the way to Iceland in order to get them. She ends up again in company of some travellers. Not everybody's what they seem to be. And then there's this mystical pair of twins who turn out to be conjoined twins imprisoned in a cavern. And if you go to them, they'll tell you the future and things. So again, eerie folkloric fantasy elements, but
fantastic.
Great historical context.
Brilliant. That's fantastic.
And I'll do it very briefly because I've talked about Juliet Marillier a lot, but she does a really great line in historical fantasy that has strong, you know, a strong sort of historical base. Usually they're set in Ireland or Scotland. And then she weaves in sort of the folkloric fantasy elements of the time. So with the Seven Waters trilogy, you've got the Shee turning up a lot. With the Brede Chronicles, you have the good folk turning up and meddling in Pictish politics.
Right.
And with Wolfskin, there's a lot of very eerie sort of Nordic god and islander mythology as well going on. So, again, I won't go into detail, but it's another good example of historical fantasy.
Fantastic. Before we go, I just want to mention that obviously historical fantasy is something that both of us have worked in some way or another. I don't think that either of us could avoid it. I know that you're technically not working in historical fantasy.
No, I've got historical fantasy planned for the future.
Yeah, me too. So
definitely. So, but when I'll get to write them, I don't know. And I'm kind of in a, oh god, I've got a horrible feeling that's got a strong romance element, so I might just write under a pen name for that.
Fair
one.
Fair enough. Before we go, it is time for our Dissecting Dragons recommendation of the week, and this week I've got one for you guys, which is completely different from the subject that we've been talking about, like, just on the other side. Though I do feel like we've actually recommended quite a few historical fantasy books at this point, so I don't feel too guilty about it. So I want to recommend an anime series, because I'm being a nerd, just going full nerd, which was recommended to me, which is My Hero Academia. I've been watching, I think we're only on the second season so far, there's four seasons, I believe, up to date. Been watching it very recently, nice quick episodes, which it's basically set in a world where people started to develop superpowers, and it's now a very common thing. About 80% of people have what they call quirks, so they have these kind of these magical abilities in some way or another. Enter the main character, Midoriya, who really, really wants to be a hero, because from all these quirks, basically people started using them for villainy, whilst other people started to use them to become superheroes, to the point that it's now that superheroes are basically public servants, as it were, and sort of help to fight crime and to maintain things. And Midoriya really wants to be a superhero. He wants to get into this special academy in order to do it, but he doesn't have a quirk. I'm not going to say any more than that. It's actually a really heartfelt series, very enjoyable. And the thing I like the best about it is it's really well paced. Anyone who's ever watched any kind of action anime know that sometimes they really draw it out and the battles last forever. And every single moment, just when something's about to happen, you've got to have about 5 minutes of flashbacks to really bring it in, and you're just thinking, oh my god, please get on with it. Whereas actually the really refreshing thing about My Hero Academia is that there's this great sense of pace. They don't draw anything out unnecessarily, but the fight sequences are still really interesting, and the concepts are really interesting as well. It's not stereotypical at all, so really recommend it for anyone who might be interested in that kind of thing, or who might want a refreshing take on the idea of superheroes. it's really quite sweet. Plus, all of their names, all of the characters' names are puns, which is hilarious. So, if you know any Japanese at all, or you're just interested in that kind of thing, it's really funny. So, highly recommend that. That's My Hero Academia.
Okay, cool.
And on that note, guys, we'll say thanks very much for listening. Do leave us a comment, get in touch with us on Twitter or on Facebook or individually. Let us know what you think about historical fantasy. Are there any that you recommend to us? Do you agree with our analysis? Do you disagree with our analysis? Let us know. But for now, we'll say thanks very much for listening, and we'll catch you guys next week.
Yeah, thanks and goodbye.
Bye.
You've been listening to Dissecting Dragons, the speculative fiction podcast. You can follow our podcast at podbean.com or from iTunes. For more information, visit our Facebook page at www.facebook.com/dissectingreaders or check out our author websites at jaironside.com and madelinevaughan.com. Please note that no dragons were harmed during the making of this podcast.